You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The story of the American Revolution has been told many times, inevitably on parallel tracks, either through the eyes of the military, the Continental Army, or political leaders, the Continental Congress. In his latest book, Revolutionary Summer, The Birth of American Independence, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Joseph J. Ellis weaves these two threads together, providing a much fuller picture of what transpired during the weeks and months that led to the creation of a new nation. Mr. Ellis, who is the Ford Foundation Professor of History Emeritus at Mount Holyoke College, won a Pulitzer Prize for his book Founding Fathers, The Revolutionary Generation, and a National Book Award for American Sphinx, the character of Thomas Jefferson. I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show today. Hello.
Leonard, it is wonderful to be back.
What was the state of the Continental Army under the command of George Washington in the spring of 1776?
I hate to tell you, but it was pretty bad. I mean, this was an army of amateurs. The average experience of a Continental Army soldier was less than 6 months. The average experience of a British soldier was 7 years, and the officer class was even more so. In the spring of 76, they're coming down from Boston, where they've just had a siege and successfully forced the British to withdraw.
But had been the Battle of Bunker Hill, hadn't there?
That's earlier. That precedes the Continental Army. That's June 5th, 75. One of the things that's interesting is, like, the war started 15 months before independence is declared, and they all think that the British are going to launch an attack on this city, New York, and they're right. And the largest amphibious force ever to cross the Atlantic up to that point, 42,000 men, is coming to land on Staten Island and then Long Island. And the army, the Continental Army, is poised to try to defend New York, both because the army is itself so inexperienced, the officers are inexperienced. I mean, the general officer in Nathaniel Greene, who turns out to be a great general over 7 years, you know, a year earlier, you know, he was a Quaker merchant in Providence, Rhode Island, never heard a shot fired in anger. And anyway, if you take a look at New York, which I'm sure you have from a helicopter, it's an archipelago. Whoever controls the seas controls the battle, and that's what happened in this.
Now, Washington did have experience because he'd fought in the French and Indian War. Hadn't other people in the Continental Army also served in that war?
There's a few of them. There's a guy called Charles Lee, and there's a guy called Daniel Morgan, who were veterans of that war. There aren't many. And there's a couple veterans of the British Army serving in the American Continental Army. It's a work in progress, to put it kindly.
And you write that Washington's goal was not to win the war, but rather not to lose it.
He figures that out in this particular summer. Because he starts out believing that, like everybody believes, the war is going to be short, it's going to be a big battle, blah, blah, blah. And he is an honor-driven man. He believes that if, in this case, General Howe presents himself on the field of battle, it's like a summons to duel, and you have to say yes. And that is a huge mistake, again, in the differences between the two militaries, the forces. But it's in this battle that he begins to realize that he should fight. It's not quite a guerrilla war, but it's what they call a war of posts, because he doesn't have to win. The British have to win. And if we can create a protracted conflict, they'll eventually decide it's not worth it and go away.
Now, you mentioned General Howe. Actually, there were two Howes.
Richard and William. Richard is the admiral, and William is the general.
And Richard, hadn't he sought unsuccessfully to lead a peace delegation to the colonies? Lord North
both
turned him down.
Both the Howes are members of Parliament. Richard, House of Lords, William, House of Commons, both voted against launching this war against the American colonies. They opposed it. And yet they agreed to serve as the commanders-in-chief of this force, hoping to come over and deliver a stunning blow to the Continental Army that would show the Americans that they really had no chance of winning, and then they could negotiate an armistice and some sort of reconciliation.
But so they come to fight the Battle of New York.
Yes.
Now, earlier there had you mentioned there was the Boston siege. What was positive was gained from that?
The siege?
Yeah.
It made the Continental Army think it was better than it was. They really had they had them outnumbered 3-1 around Boston. And eventually, and they established military superiority on Dorchester Heights that forced the British to have to retreat, and they sailed away to Halifax. So it's called Evacuation Day in Boston. It's a big day. And but it convinced many people in the Congress that a Continental Army of devoted, virtuous patriots could defeat an army of professional veterans. And that was a mistake.
Who was the Continental Army receiving orders from?
Continental Congress down in Philadelphia. Civilian control was assumed and established right away.
And was there agreement, general agreement?
Yeah. Washington did what they told him to do. And you know, when they said defend Boston, he did that. When they said go to New York, he did that. The problem is that the Continental Army should be based on quotas of men and money from each of the respective colonies cum states. The Continental Congress keeps requesting that, and they never get what they're asking for. If given the age structure and demography of the American population, they could have had a Continental Army of 120,000. They're never more than 12,000 to 15,000.
Well, there was resistance in some areas. In fact, when there was a call for signing a Declaration of Independence, states like New York and Pennsylvania resisted.
They are reticent about this. They all agree on one thing, that Parliament's policies towards them are misguided and cannot be accepted, but they don't agree that independence is the proper course, especially in New York and Pennsylvania. You got that right. They really think that a war against the British Empire is suicidal.
Now, on the other side, why didn't the British Empire negotiate with the colonies, giving them some control over their affairs while keeping them under the crown?
Leonard, have just told them about 230 years late what they should have done.
Well, there must have been somebody in England. There were a lot of smart
William
people.
Pitt William Pitt and Edmund Burke both said that was the proper course, both very prominent British statesmen. But it's really George III who's the diabolical figure here. And so all those things against George III and the Declaration are somewhat justified. But if they had done what you suggest, essentially allow the colonists to tax and legislate for themselves in their own local assemblies, but remain within the empire under the economic policy of the Navigation Acts and under the protective canopy of the monarch.
Kind of like a Commonwealth nation.
They would have discovered the British Commonwealth 100 years early. That's what would have happened. This was the most misguided decision in the history of British statecraft.
My guest is Joseph J. Ellis, whose latest book is Revolutionary Summer, The Birth of American Independence. You've written about this era before. What have you brought to this story that's new?
It's the story itself, I think, that's new. To say new, almost nothing is new. It's fresh, and in some ways, it's so old, it's new. I mean, if you think back on every generation writes its own interpretation of the Revolution, and it's like a series of layers of wallpaper. And in some ways, I'm trying to scrape that away and get back to the plaster or the wood or whatever the original is. But by putting together the military side of the story and the political side of the story and saying that they're really one story, and that those two sides interact, that I think gives the story a different feel.
Did the military and the Continental Congress have shared goals? Or because it seems to me at times they're seeing a different kind of outcome.
Well, up until the summer of up until July 4th, they are not seeing the same goals because the Army's obviously committed to war, and they're in that war. And the Continental Congress is living a fiction, namely that we're not going to war and this is really avoidable. John Adams says that they are waiting for a Messiah who will never come. And And so they're not quite on the same page here. Washington is waiting for them to catch up. And as I said, most people don't realize it, but it's 15 months between the time of Lexington Concord and the signing of the Declaration.
Well, how much improvisation was going on, making it up as they went along?
Yeah.
On the battlefield and within the
Continental Congress? In both places. I mean, whenever you're in the midst of a revolution, you're confused. And one historian said that a revolution is a change in human affairs so traumatic that no one understands it at the time or ever after. And they're hoping that the Continental Congress is hoping they're going to be able to find get Britain to agree to some form of reconciliation.
And Benjamin Franklin was one of the people who was talking about that. He finally changed his mind.
He's late to the cause. He's in Britain up until 75, and in London, and trying to convince the Brits that they're crazy if they kill the goose that laid the golden egg. But once they repudiate him, he becomes a very stout and staunch patriot. His son is actually a Tory governor of New Jersey, and he disowns him. And he's one of the most pungent and potent advocates for the military conflict once he arrives.
When did New York and Pennsylvania join the cause?
It's a complicated story, but Pennsylvania eventually signs they don't sign it. People think that they signed it on the 4th. They sent it to the printer on the 4th. That's the only thing that happened on the 4th. That's why do we celebrate the 4th? Most of them signed it.
What's it called, a printer's day?
Most of them signed it on the 2nd of August, and Pennsylvania got in time to do that. New York, some of their guys didn't sign until October.
Well, there were positive outcomes from the loss of the Battle of New York, weren't there?
Yeah, it's what I was trying to allude to a little earlier, namely that here is a battle that nearly produced the total annihilation of the Continental Army.
We came really close to losing
the war. Came really close on Long Island. They had them trapped, and they let them get away across the East River at night. It was an early version of Dunkirk. But Washington begins to internalize the fact that this is going to be a long war. It's not going to be a short war. Every time wars start, everybody on both sides thinks it's going to be a short war, and it seldom is. And in this case,
as we
have learned ourselves, and in this case, Washington begins to internalize the need to the strategic center of the rebellion isn't a place. It's not New York. It's not Philadelphia. It's not Boston. It's the Continental Army. If you can hold that together and only engage the enemy in battles when the terrain or the tactical situation is in your favor, then your chances of winning are very, very good. And in fact, instead of saying, how can the British possibly lose this war, given their military superiority, once the Americans understand they're fighting a kind of guerrilla counterinsurgency war, it's almost impossible for the Brits to win.
When did the Brits realize that they were fighting that kind of war? Had they miscalculated or underestimated the Continental Army?
Yeah, they thought that they hadn't underestimated. They just realized they did have such military superiority. Taken together, the British Army and Navy are the most powerful military in the world. And if you think about it, I mean, how many wars did Great Britain lose between 1750 and 1950? Two. The United States and Afghanistan. Hmm. That's it. But
what about the War of 1812? Do we consider that a loss?
That's a draw. That's both sides return to the status quo ante.
Now, the Continental Congress did not address the issue of slavery, despite the fact that there were stirring words in the Declaration of Independence.
Mm.
Would any of this have happened if they had tried to resolve that?
There's in the play, 1776, they have this moment when Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin and Adams get together and just try to talk about this. That moment never really happened. But it's dramatic, but it's not historically correct. What is true is that when the matter of slavery came up, and came up on how you count inhabitants for the matter of taxation. This was in July of 76, at the same time they're dealing with the Declaration. South Carolina said, if you put slavery on the table, we're out of here. Secession from the Union. and they're going to do that in 1861. It is such an explosive and volatile issue that they want to just put it aside. They put it aside in part because some people, Adams, believed that slavery was going to die a natural death. Slave labor could not compete with free labor. They were wrong about that. But if they had insisted on the slavery issue in the Continental Congress in the summer of 76, the revolution would have failed.
Joseph J. Ellis is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Founding Brothers, and his Portrait of Thomas Jefferson, American Sphinx, won the National Book Award. He's the Ford Foundation Professor of History Emeritus at Mount Holyoke College. And his latest book is Revolutionary Summer, The Birth of American Independence. It's published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being with us again.
It's lovely to be here again, Leonard.